Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus an extra $100 off all mattresses. End Saturday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and I am glad to be back after a week of my kids being sick and then their nanny being sick. And so we were just out for the count for what felt like forever. So if you were wondering where the weekly docket was, I didn't get that done last week because I was with my children. And so you're just going to have to deal with it. But guess what? There will be one this week. I won't let you down. I'm going to record it on Thursday because obviously there is a lot going on in the world of true crime this week. As far as the Nancy Guthrie case, I feel like there's really no substantial update in that case. I kind of backed off on covering it because it was starting to feel a little bit icky, if I'm being honest. You know, from the very beginning, I thought something was off with Annie and her husband. And of course, Ashley Banfield's reporting that she spoke with someone who was close to the police department who said that the son-in-law was a prime suspect. You know, all of this was garnering a lot of attention online, and it made a lot of sense in our minds as, you know, just observers, spectators of true crime. But there was still something in the back of my mind that was like, what if he really didn't do it, though? And we're all just talking about this guy as if he certainly has something to do with it. And I understand it's like the natural evolution of where your mind goes. You usually go to someone who's close to the victim, and then you kind of go outward. So I get it. I totally get it. But after the surveillance videos came out of the creepy guy on the front porch, you know, people were speculating, understandably, that maybe it was one of his bandmates, but there was just so much speculation that the truth was getting lost in the weeds. Anything that was verifiable was getting lost in the weeds. So I just kind of backed off. There was obviously the first detainment out of Rio Rico, where the guy was pulled over while he was delivering DoorDash, and he was detained and questioned for hours, and they searched his home. Nothing came from that. And then there was another operation last weekend. It was like the first weekend was that first arrest, and then the second weekend was the second round of activity where they had this like late night operation. They detained a bunch of people. They took in a Range Rover for evidence. And then again, we didn't hear about any arrests from that. And then in the meantime, you have all these ransom notes coming in. I mean, the whole thing just kind of is beginning to feel a little bit like a clown show or like a bad movie. And so I think what I've decided personally, and this is just me, obviously other creators are going to continue to follow this, but I think I'm just going to kind of like pull back from that case and reconvene once we have some verifiable information. I have heard that there was a glove found in the backyard, and the DNA that was extracted from that glove does not match anyone closely related to the Guthries. And so they think it could potentially be DNA of whoever was involved in Nancy's abduction. Until that actually comes out and is verified, I'm just going to wait. So anyway, that's kind of how I feel about the Nancy Guthrie situation. Moving on into the story that I'm bringing you today, it comes out of Raleigh County, West Virginia. And this one is really just a lot. There's a lot to take in. And so this is going to be a longer episode. If you need to, you know, break it into two parts, I totally understand. But I'm just going to go ahead and get this done all in one, an extra long episode for you guys as a thank you for being so patient while I was taking care of my children. So by the time people in Raleigh County, West Virginia realized that something was wrong, it was not just that something was off. It was that everything was off. And I mean, this is like the most convoluted, crazy, twisty story that you're going to hear from me in a while. From the outside, Michael and Natalie Cochran looked like a couple that people could trust. They're this beautiful couple. They had a life that read very well on paper. They had two kids, a boy and a girl. They had a nice home. They're always busy, always involved, always on the go. You know, they're the kind of family that you would see at sporting events and fundraisers and church functions. They're one of the couples who seemed like they were doing everything right. But behind that version of things, there were cracks, as there always are. And they were small ones at first, the kinds that you don't typically notice until someone else close to the couple maybe points them out. And then it gets to a point where you just cannot stop seeing them. And in this case, those cracks did not just lead to one problem. They led to a whole chain of events that left a lot of people stunned, a lot of people really angry, and one family completely changed. So to make sense of what happened, we have to go back to the beginning, back to who Michael Cochran was, how Natalie came into his life, and how the two of them became the kind of couple that everyone thought they knew. This is the unbelievable story of Michael and Natalie Cochran. Michael Brandon Cochran was born on December 23rd of 1980 in Beckley, West Virginia. He was an only child raised primarily by his mother, Donna, and when he was about 8 years old, Donna married Ed Bolt, who would become Michael's stepfather. And by all accounts, that relationship was very sincere. Ed stepped in fully, he helped raise him, coached him, supported him. The two ended up being very close. He might as well have been like Michael's dad. Michael grew up in Raleigh County in a tight-knit Appalachian, you guys will correct me however I'm supposed to say that word, community, where people tend to kind of know each other's business and where your reputation really matters. And from early on, his reputation was a very good one. Donna had described him as disciplined and driven. He did not miss school. He stayed on the honor roll. He was involved in the extracurriculars. He was athletic, very athletic, and very competitive. In a way that pushed him, not in like a reckless or arrogant way. Sports were just a big part of his identity growing up, and they would become a big part of his identity later, as you'll see. He loved football, baseball, lifting weights, anything that was physical. And that passion for fitness did not fade with age. It actually intensified. When he was just 10 years old, he got his first set of barbells, and Donna actually talked about how he would go into his room, turn his music up, and just work out for hours. And by the time he was older, he was competing. At one point, he even won first place in a powerlifting competition. And that really mattered to him. Achievement mattered to him. Competing and working for something mattered to him. He wasn't just someone who floated through life. After high school, Michael attended West Virginia University, where he studied information technology. And that made sense for him because he was always very structured, logical, he liked problem solving, and of course, IT was a lot of those things. But before college really even got going, something else happened that would shape the rest of his life. When Michael was just 17 years old, he went into a sporting goods store with his mom, and behind the counter that day was a girl named Natalie Jessup. Donna noticed it immediately. The two were flirting. She could see it happening right there before her eyes. Michael tried to brush it off, but not long after that, Michael and Natalie started dating. You could say that it was like love at first sight. And things moved very quickly, very quickly. They both enrolled at West Virginia University. Natalie was studying pharmacy and Michael was in IT. And during their first semester of college, when most people are just kind of figuring out dorm life and trying to get their class schedules figured out, these two got engaged. And that really surprised a lot of people, especially considering how young they were. And Donna, you know, Michael's mom, had been open about the fact that she was worried that this was moving too fast. She wanted her son to focus on school, on building his future. But the relationship was intense and the momentum was already there. There was no stopping this. So in November of 1999, Natalie called Donna to say they were getting married. By May of 2000, they did, and Michael was just 19 years old. From the outside, it looked like a young couple deeply in love, building something early and ambitiously. And in those early years, that's largely what it was. They both finished school, Michael went into IT, Natalie became a licensed pharmacist. They eventually settled in Daniels, West Virginia, on a 4-acre property that Michael really poured himself into renovating. He worked on that home himself, fixing things, upgrading things, really turning it into their own space. And then they had two children, a son who I think is still a minor, and a daughter who is now an adult named Nicole. And if you talk to people who knew Michael during those years, you hear the same themes, that he was involved. He coached youth sports. He showed up for all the practices. He volunteered. He helped his friends. When a local woman named Toni lost her husband to leukemia, Michael stepped up to help her kids. He would take them fishing. He would show up to their games. Like, that is not just performative. That is who he was. He was steady, grounded, and the kind of man who built his life brick by brick, family, career, community. But as much as this story is about Michael, it's also about the woman he married when he was still a teenager. While Michael was described as being structured and straightforward, Natalie was described very differently. She was very charismatic, intelligent, and confident and ambitious. She had a doctorate in pharmacy. She knew how to speak the language of authority, whether that was medical jargon, financial, or professional. People tended to trust her. And as we move forward in this story, understanding who Natalie was and how she operated becomes just as important as understanding Michael. Natalie Jessup was also raised in Southern West Virginia. She grew up in a traditional Appalachian community, and by all accounts, she was bright from a very young age. She was academically driven, focused, the kind of student who didn't just want to do well, she wanted to excel. So, you know, she has that in common with Michael, who's competitive in a little bit of a different way. But she went on to attend West Virginia University, where she pursued her degree in pharmacy, which is obviously not an easy path. Pharmacy school is demanding. It requires discipline, a level of intelligence, long hours, and the ability to master some extremely technical and scientific, like, chemical information. That is just so above my pay grade. When it comes to science, I'm like, y'all wait till I tell you someday about my 23andMe story and how naive I was about DNA. But anyway, moving on. Natalie earned her Doctor of Pharmacy degree, which immediately placed her in a respected and high-paying profession. And in a place like Raleigh County, that carries a lot of weight. Friends later described her as being very confident, outgoing, socially polished. She knew how to network. She knew how to talk to people. And she seemed comfortable being the one that was in charge of things. However, when she and Michael were younger, some tension reportedly existed between Natalie and Michael's mother, Donna. There was something that happened that just did not sit right. And to this day, Donna has never explicitly detailed exactly what that was that happened between them. One can surmise that it was disagreements around the wedding, but we just don't know specifically what. There were claims that Natalie tried to create distance between Michael and his parents. But at the time, you know, those things can look like normal in-law friction, nothing that really screams warning signs. So after college, Natalie began working as a pharmacist. She specialized in diabetes management at one point, which is an important piece of context later, but at the same time, it simply reinforced her reputation as someone who was knowledgeable and capable and trustworthy. She and Michael built a life that looked very stable. They had their two children. They lived on that 4-acre property in Daniels. You know, Michael's working IT. Natalie is working pharmacy. They're active in church and sports. And Natalie took on organizational roles, managing sporting events for their baseball league, and then ordering uniforms, eventually serving as treasurer for a local middle school baseball team, which we will get to. But this is where something kind of subtle started to show up, because Natalie didn't just participate. She would position herself in roles of control, especially roles of handling money, managing logistics, overseeing operations. By 2017, though, something shifted. After years in pharmacy, Natalie announced that she would be leaving her job to start something new, a government contracting business. The company was called TSG, which stood for Tactical Solutions Group. Now, government contracting is not illegal. It's not even unusual. Private companies can bid on government contracts to supply goods and services, but it is very complex. It requires connections, paperwork, certifications, financial backing. It's not something that you can just, like, decide tomorrow that you want to be a part of. And Natalie told people that she was inspired by the movie War Dogs, which if you've seen it, your ears were probably already perking up. Like, this sounds like a movie I've seen. And oh, you have no idea. But War Dogs, if you haven't seen it, is a film about small-time operators who land massive military contracts. And she reportedly had employees watch this movie as part of the onboarding process, which in hindsight feels like a strange choice if you've ever seen the movie, because spoiler alert, skip ahead if you don't want to hear this, but spoiler alert, the two that are in charge of this contracting business end up in prison at the end. And she's like inspired by this movie. But at the same time, you know, maybe it just sounded bold and ambitious. And maybe she wanted to do it the right way and try to avoid prison time. Maybe she saw their scheme and thought there's got to be a way to do this legally. You know, maybe, I don't know. I'm just trying to paint this picture for you in a way that extends even a little bit of grace, because I just always imagine people at the time living through this. And, you know, obviously no one had the foresight of what was to come. So I'm thinking of how people are perceiving this in real time. And, you know, that is the benefit of the doubt that I would have given her at the time, probably. But she explained to friends and family that she and Michael were bidding on large government contracts for military equipment, medical supplies, tactical gear. She talked about being a woman-owned business. She talked about high-level agencies, the Department of Defense, Homeland Security. Like, it all sounded impressive and lucrative and legitimate, right? Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now, let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing: homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day. You can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com. Lately, I've been thinking about how most of us are trying to be healthier, but we're honestly just guessing sometimes. We're taking supplements, we're following workout trends, saving wellness tips, and hoping something sticks. But what if the thing everyone's recommending isn't actually what your specific body needs? Well, that is why I tried True Diagnostic. They test your biological age, so not just how old you are on paper, but how your body is actually aging, along with key health markers like inflammation and nutrients. And instead of overwhelming you with data, they give you a really clear 90-day plan so you know exactly what to focus on next. So I took the test myself, and it was genuinely so easy. The kit showed up at my house. It was just a quick finger prick, and then I dropped it in the prepaid envelope, done. I'm waiting on my results now, and I'm really curious about inflammation and my nutrient levels, especially with how busy life is right now. But what I like most about True Diagnostic is that it takes the guesswork out of wellness. It helps you figure out what supplements and lifestyle changes actually matter for you specifically, and which ones might just be wasting your money. They have a few options depending on what you're looking for. There's True Age, which focuses on longevity and how fast you're aging. There's True Health, which looks at your health right now, or you can do the combo kit, which kind of gives you the full picture. No matter which you choose, you get your top three actions to focus on for the next 90 days, which makes it feel doable. And this isn't just influencer wellness stuff. True Diagnostic uses advanced epigenetic testing and is trusted by longevity clinics and health professionals. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, True is spelled T-R-U, diagnostic.com, and use code MAMA for 20% off today. You can choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase, or you can do a subscription. Now, if you're already spending time and money trying to feel better, this just helps you make sure it's actually working. So when you try it and when you fall in love with it, be sure to let me know. Getting dressed should not be that hard. And yet somehow, whenever I'm like trying to dress up to go on a date or do something fun with Austin, I'm usually standing in front of a full closet thinking, I have nothing to wear. And that is why I love Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy with a clothing rental membership that builds a wardrobe just for you with high quality, unique brands that actually make sense for your life. You take a quick 5-minute style quiz, pick items from your personalized closet, and they show up at your door in as little as 2 days. When you're ready for something new, you just swap them out and that's it. I've been using Armoire because my body, my lifestyle, and just my personal style have all changed, and buying new clothes every time just isn't feeling realistic. One of my favorite pieces I've rented was actually this white and blue dress that Austin and I went to a Teddy Swims concert. I wore the dress. I actually posted a video of us dancing at the concert and it went kind of viral. And I had so many people asking me where I got this dress, and I rented it from Armoire. And I'll also be honest, I've always felt guilty about how many things in my closet I've only worn once, if at all. Some things still have a tag on them, but Armoire completely changed that for me. I get to stay on trend, wear beautiful designer pieces, and then there's also like loungewear that I love too. I had this really beautiful floral Kate Spade wind jacket, like wind blazer. It was so cute. I wore it on vacation, got lots of compliments, and then when I didn't feel like wearing it anymore, you just send it back. It's so easy. Another huge bonus, Armoire is women-founded and women-led. They even spotlight women-owned designers, which makes me feel good about where my money is going. So if you're struggling to define your style right now, or maybe your body is changing because of fitness or pregnancy or just life, Armoire is such a good solution. You can size up, size down, try new silhouettes, and swap whenever you need to. There's no commitment, no pressure, just clothes that fit you where you are. And somehow it's all designer without the designer price tag. Instead of spending hundreds on one dress that I might wear one time, I kind of get this rotating closet of high-end pieces for a fraction of the cost. Fashion math finally makes sense. It's not girl math, it's fashion math. One feature I have to mention is quarterly rentals, because Armoire is the only rental company that lets you keep favorite pieces for an entire season for just $10 a month. So if you find something you truly love, you don't have to give it back right away. And if you decide to keep it, then that fee ends up going towards the final purchase. You get to decide what stays for a month, a season, or forever. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama, M-A-M-A, to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today and thank me tomorrow. And here's where understanding Natalie really matters, because she did not just present those details hesitantly. She presented them confidently, with authority, with language that made it sound legitimate. And because she already had credibility as a pharmacist, As someone educated and successful, people believed her. When she spoke about contracts, she used urgency. When she talked about returns, she talked about short timelines and large profits and, you know, all these buzzwords like classified and confidential, which obviously conveniently limits how much anyone could really push. If they ask a question and you're like, oh, well, I can't, that's government classification, you know, they're not going to push much further. But at the center of it all, she positioned herself as the 51% owner of the company, which made Michael holding 49%. And the explanation given was that it would allow them to qualify themselves as a woman-owned business for government bidding advantages. So on paper, that sounds smart, but in reality, it also meant that Natalie maintained majority control and that Michael was, you know, not that. People later described her as the brains of the business. Not that Michael wasn't intelligent, it's just that Natalie handled the majority of, you know, the business side of it all, the financial side, the banking, the investor conversations, the paperwork. You know, Michael was the relationship builder. He's the baseball coach, the helper, the guy who showed up. He's charismatic and he has a good heart and a moral compass. He's a family guy. Whereas Natalie was the architect, the planner, the one directing the money. So in the beginning, so between 2017 and 2019, she starts reaching out to some of her closest friends, neighbors, and even her in-laws, Donna and Ed Bolt, to see if they would be interested in investing in TSG. She took advantage of those close relationships, as well as her authority as a licensed pharmacist, to present herself as a reliable and trustworthy figure. Beyond that, she showed them letters from Senator Joe Manchin's office and emails from a Federal Reserve employee and examples of government contracts that would make these investments look like a guaranteed win. But another spoiler alert, none of it was real. The pitch was straightforward. You know, it was basically give us the capital to fulfill these quote unquote one contracts and you'll get a high interest return once the government pays out. And so in total, she persuaded at least 11 people to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars into TSG with the promise that they would make their money back and then some as soon as the government paid out for basically a contract that they had already signed and won and, you know, moved forward with. As the business supposedly took off, their lifestyle changed almost immediately. They started making bigger purchases. They started buying luxury items. They traveled more. They bought more property. In fact, they even bought an airplane hangar because Michael liked planes and he was working on getting his pilot's license. All of this from the outside looked like signs of success. At one point, Natalie withdrew $37,500 to buy a 1965 Shelby Cobra. They eventually owned three separate homes. They bought more antique cars and a motorcycle. They went on vacations to Paris and to Hawaii. And here's the thing about lifestyle inflation in a small Appalachian town, it does not go unnoticed. Raleigh County is not like Manhattan or New York. When someone's financial status dramatically changes, people clock it in a small town. They may not say anything at first, but they see it. They're talking about it. Friends who had invested in TSG saw these new vehicles and these new purchases and the apparent ease in life, and it reinforced the illusion. It made the story believable because if the money wasn't real, then how were they living like that? But that's part of what makes a Ponzi scheme so effective. This early visible success becomes proof of viability, right? The lifestyle becomes marketing. And by many accounts, Michael was enjoying it. He hadn't grown up with wealth. So stepping into that level of comfort, you know, being able to give, donate, buy equipment for teams, help out his friends, that probably felt validating. Like all of the hard work was starting to pay off. He donated a weight room to a local school. He helped financially support people in need. There was generosity there. Michael and Natalie were involved in local youth sports, like I mentioned earlier. Michael often coached their son's baseball team, and Natalie was usually the team mom. But as she built trust within her community, she also offered to hold an officer position as the league's treasurer, the league being Shady Spring Youth Baseball League. So she was at all the games. She helped manage the league's logistics, ordering their uniforms and serving as a point of contact for parents. And she was also involved in her daughter's softball team and volleyball team. You know, they're very involved in all the things. But behind the scenes, the math was starting to not add up. Because what investigators would later determine is that TSG never actually secured legitimate government contracts. There was no $1 million sitting in accounts waiting to clear, no massive Department of Defense payouts on the horizon. Instead, this new investor money was being used to cover old promises. Banks were being tapped, lines of credit were being stretched, and the spending never slowed down. And they were filling out, I say they, it was mostly Natalie because she was obviously the majority owner in the company, but she would apply for bank loans alleging that her company was worth $500 million when it wasn't. And so she was, you know, obtaining these bank loans in a fraudulent way. Meanwhile, you have Michael, who's, you know, outward facing, community driven, emotional, showing up for people, whereas Natalie was more inward facing when it came to money. She was strategic and controlled and very protective of financial details. She handled the accounts. She handled investor communications. She controlled the narrative. I just think it's very important to stress the dichotomy in their relationship because as we move through this story, I want everyone to be aware that I don't believe, and I don't think you should either, that Michael was fully aware of the fraudulent activity that was happening behind the scenes. And I will have proof for that. We will get into that. But, you know, as long as the money appeared to be flowing, the image held. So they were spending over $2,000 on Yeti coolers, over $1,100 at Dick's Sporting Goods, over $1,300 on Amazon, over $500 for WVU baseball season tickets, and over $400 for a new compound bow and arrow used for hunting. And while they are buying all of this stuff, people who had invested money were starting to realize that their returns were not materializing. You know, their promised payouts were, you know, stalling. When excuses started stacking up, that luxury lifestyle stopped looking like success and started feeling like something else. And so that is when the cracks stopped being small. In fact, what I think really tipped a lot of people off was when Natalie organized a fundraiser for the baseball and volleyball leagues. She hosted it at her house, and it was like a bingo style event. And the big hook was that TSG was going to be donating some firearms as prizes, specifically some semi-automatic weapons. Now, in West Virginia, that kind of prize doesn't automatically raise eyebrows the way that it might anywhere else, but it was marketed as a major draw, and it worked because the event reportedly brought in about $32,000. And the understanding was that $16,000 would go to the baseball league and $16,000 would go to the volleyball league. But almost immediately, there were problems. First of all, there was a $16,000 check written from TSG that bounced. And that's not a small clerical error. That's obviously a massive red flag when you're telling everyone your business is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and yet you bounce a $16,000 check. Then there were board members that kind of started looking closer at the accounts of the baseball league, and they realized that money was missing. There were transactions that had been made that no one on the board had approved, purchases that had nothing to do with baseball or volleyball. So an audit was conducted in May and June of 2018. And when they finished reviewing the account, there was only $32 left. $32. That is what was left in the account that was supposed to support these kids, their uniforms, their equipment, travel, like a whole season of sports. That's insane. They could see the money that was being spent at Dick's Sporting Goods and the money being spent on Yeti coolers and Amazon charges and retail stores and restaurants, ATM withdrawals, the bow and arrow, the season tickets. Like, they could see all of that. So while the outside image was this thriving government contractor, behind the scenes, Natalie was pulling money from a youth baseball league. So that fundraiser really should have been a turning point, but it wasn't. Nothing official happened. There was no criminal charges that came from it at the time. There were suspicions and questions and chatter, but there was no public reckoning, which I don't understand. Obviously, that silence just gave Natalie more time. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people who were invested in this in the beginning are kicking themselves now. But, you know, I think it's time we start shaming people like this, publicly shaming people that just take advantage of vulnerable people, families, children. I think it's time that you start exposing people like this. But and instead of waiting until it gets to the point that it did in the Cochran case, which you will see. At the same time that the baseball league was discovering that their account had been drained, investors were starting to ask their own questions as well. And at first it was polite, like just, hey, checking in on that payout timeline. Do we have an update on when the government funds are clearing? And Natalie always had an answer. The government is slow. There was an audit. The funds were being verified. Oh, there was a delay because of compliance, because of banking regulations. And then came December of 2018, when there was a federal government shutdown. And suddenly, Natalie had the perfect excuse. If the government wasn't functioning, of course contracts weren't being paid. Of course wires weren't clearing. Of course everything is delayed. So for a while, that explanation worked. But then the shutdown ended. And when the money still didn't appear, the tension shifted. So then Natalie starts telling people, you guys, get this. She starts telling people she had stage 3 leukemia, which that in itself is medically inaccurate because leukemia is not staged that way. It's categorized by type. You have acute versus chronic. You have lymphocytic, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, versus myeloid. So that detail stood out to at least one person whose husband actually died from leukemia. But when Natalie was questioned about it, she would just tell people that she was going to let God handle it and that she wasn't going to pursue aggressive treatment. So that effectively shut down most follow-up questions and also created this emotional distance from financial pressures, because who's going to chase down repayment from a girl that's dying of cancer? You'd have to be a monster. Now, it was around this time, early 2019, that she began claiming she was going to go under treatment. And she started showing people this bald patch on the back of her head that she said was from chemo. But multiple friends testified that it actually just looked like a shaved patch and not actual hair loss. And how, like, the audacity that you would have, not only to lie about having cancer, but to shave an inconspicuous patch in the back of your head where your hair is probably going to cover it, just so that you can say, oh yeah, I've lost hair from chemo. Check out this tiny little patch that's conveniently hidden by the rest of my hair. Like, what an awful person you must be. Now, around this same time period, Michael was starting to ask questions about the business because people were starting to come to him directly. Friends, community members, even his own parents, Donna and Ed, who had invested their entire retirement savings, over $245,000 his parents invested into TSG. And Michael did not have answers for them. According to testimony later presented in court, he was becoming very frustrated. He was confused. He was getting embarrassed. He believed what Natalie had told him about the contracts, about the millions that were supposedly sitting in Bank of America accounts in Virginia. But when the deposits wouldn't hit, when the wires didn't show up, he started pushing. And there are text messages between them from late January and early February of 2019 that paint a very different picture than this confident front that Natalie presented publicly. On January 31st of 2019, Natalie texted Michael that she was on the phone with Bank of America. Michael responded asking, quote, are we 1,000%? End quote. And she said, yes. Then on February 4th, he texted her, money isn't there. End quote. And, you know, the context is sort of missing from these, but I think it's fair to assume that they're talking about where the money is, when it's going to be landing finally, so that they can start paying their friends back, right? So she replies to Michael that the wire department said large transfers were being verified, that millions of dollars, specifically $4.8 million in one transaction, and then over $23 million in another would show up in their accounts very soon. And according to testimony at trial, Natalie had told both Michael and investors that millions of dollars, supposedly from government contracts, were sitting in a Bank of America account in Virginia. She again claimed that the funds were delayed due to verification issues, large transfer amounts, compliance reviews, things like that. And Michael answered and he responded via text saying, "Doesn't make sense to me." That right there is the clue to me that, you know, for the first time, it sounds like Michael was not just repeating Natalie's story. He's actually questioning it and genuinely had some doubts about it. And, you know, the frustration is brewing. And so the frustration doesn't brew over knowing that this is a scam. It's believing in its legitimacy, right? So then comes this plan to fly to Virginia. On February 6th of 2019, Michael and Natalie were scheduled to charter a flight to Lynchburg to visit a specific Bank of America branch. Natalie had told the bank that they were opening an account and depositing millions of dollars. Now, Michael believed that they were going to resolve this issue to figure out why the funds were not appearing. But here is the problem. If they would have walked into that bank together, the truth would come out immediately that there was no $1 million, there were no contracts, there was no wire delay. So that meeting had the potential to collapse everything. That meeting could not happen. And early the morning of February 6th, Natalie canceled the flight. She told the pilot, who testified to this later, and the bank that she was sick and needed to cancel. And within hours, Michael would be the one to collapse inside of their home. So let's get into the details of that day, February 6, 2019. This was supposed to be the day that Michael and Natalie finally went in person to a Bank of America in Lynchburg, Virginia. Now, according to trial testimony, Natalie had canceled the charter flight early that morning and, you know, said she was too sick to fly. Except this is where the story starts branching out immediately because the sickness explanation becomes part of the setup for what happens next. You see, that morning, Natalie starts telling people that she's sick. She's cancer sick. She's sick from her cancer and that she needs insulin, which I know doesn't make any sense. So she's communicating with friends, including her friend Jennifer and Chris Davis, and framing what was going on as a spiral of illness. Now, the way that it was described later is that Natalie told Jennifer she had the flu and norovirus, that she was extra sick because of cancer, that she had been given a high dose of steroids, and that the steroids had elevated her blood sugar, so she needed insulin to regulate it. Jennifer, thinking that she was being a helping friend who, you know, understood diabetes and medications because her son actually has type 1 diabetes, she knew that, you know, she could trust Natalie's pharmaceutical background and that Jennifer would likely have insulin on hand and that she could probably get it to her without it being traced through a pharmacy. But it's worth noting that neither Natalie or Michael ever had diabetes or any history of diabetes. So around 10:30 a.m., the insulin is dropped off at the Cochran home by Jennifer and Chris Davis. Now, at some point after this delivery, Natalie's story is that Michael went into the kitchen, got sick while he was standing at the sink, and then ended up on the floor. And a contractor who worked for the Cochrans, his name is Jason Bowen, he testified that Natalie told him Michael had gotten sick at the sink and kind of lowered himself down onto the floor using the cabinet. And the detail that matters here is how Michael is found. He's on the kitchen floor. He's in a curled up position. He's unresponsive. Jason testified later that he was at Lowe's when Natalie texted him around noon, asking him and his business partner to come to the house because Michael was sick and laying on the floor. So when Jason and his partner arrived, Michael's still on the floor, still unresponsive. At around 12:30, Natalie sends out a photo of Michael on the floor of their kitchen. He's kind of laying on his right side, but like leaning with his face towards the ground. He appears to be laying on top of his right arm with his left arm just kind of slightly bent out in front of him. His legs are bent, like he's almost in a fetal position. But obviously, you know, he looks like he's laying on the floor. And this is one of the clearest time anchors in the whole day, this photo that was taken and distributed at around 12:30 that day. Jennifer and Chris later described receiving this photo of Michael on the kitchen floor about 2 hours after the insulin drop-off. So that would certainly add up because they said they left the insulin on the porch around 10 or 10:30. Now, public reporting about the case has also referenced 12:29 as the time that Natalie took that photo. But either way, we're in the same narrow window of around 12:30. So the contractors arrive and Natalie is asking them to move Michael from the floor to the couch. And Jason, one of the contractors, testified that they tried to speak to him repeatedly. They're saying his name. They're trying to get any kind of response, but he was not responding. His partner then performed a sternal rub, which is like a painful stimulus that is used usually to gauge responsiveness. It's supposed to be painful. It's supposed to ignite a response. So Jason said Michael made some level of response. It was like a groan, but he was not waking up or communicating normally. And this is where the day becomes a series of missed opportunities because the people that were physically in that home, people who were not medically clueless, were telling her, like, he needs to go see a doctor. He doesn't look good. He needs to go to the hospital. Jason testified that he believed Michael should have been taken to the hospital. He also testified that they were capable of loading him into a car and taking him, and that they even asked Natalie if she wanted them to help her do that. And she said no. By early to mid-afternoon, a medical professional finally tries to intervene. John Hamilton, who was a state trooper and friend, contacted his wife, Stephanie Hamilton, who was a physician assistant, because he wanted to help convince Natalie to get Michael to the hospital. So Stephanie testified that she was summoned to the house specifically for that reason. When Stephanie arrived, she did not take Michael's vitals herself. She testified that Natalie gave her the vitals. And Stephanie did take his temperature, said it was normal, and she observed him turn his head towards her. But she suggested that, you know, they needed to take him to a hospital. She's even saying, like, you could go to this hospital, you could go to this hospital. Again, Natalie keeps declining. And this matters because the picture that Natalie was painting to people outside of the home was basically, he's fine, he's just sleeping it off, he doesn't want to go. But the people who were actually seeing him with their own eyes were not describing a man who was just choosing not to go, they were describing a man who was not functioning. So throughout the afternoon, Natalie keeps telling people, oh, he's going to sleep it off, he'll be fine. And this is where things turn into a slow, maddening stall. Jennifer described the messaging as if Natalie was communicating with Michael, saying he won't go to the hospital, which gives this impression that he's awake and that he is refusing care. But friends were checking in repeatedly and being told some version of, you know, he's fine, he's sleeping it off, he's going to sleep it off, whatever. Meanwhile, hours keep passing and Michael is still unresponsive. By early evening, around 6:30, Natalie texted Chris Davis asking him to come by after his basketball game. Now, in the 2020 episode that covers this story, Chris describes getting that message around 6:30 p.m. and then going over there. And when Chris arrived and saw Michael's condition, he would not accept the sleep it off explanation. He insisted Michael needed to go to the hospital immediately and said he was taking him. And that matches trial reporting about Chris's testimony where he said he told Natalie, yes, he needs to go, he's going now, and basically just disregarded any kind of pushback Natalie, you know, may have tried to offer. He was like, I don't give a shit what you have to say at this point, we're going. So with that, Michael is taken to Raleigh General Hospital. When he arrives, his blood glucose is at 21, which is a critically low number that medical witnesses emphasized as profoundly abnormal and consistent with coma-level hypoglycemia. Now, for reference, a level of 70 to 99 is what is considered to be normal. Below 70 is considered to be low blood sugar or hypoglycemic. Below 55, it's, you know, starting to get considered as severe. And at or below 40, you can expect confusion, seizures, loss of consciousness. And then around 20, that's a life-threatening emergency. So at the hospital, he is intubated. And even then, his mother, Donna, doesn't learn what's happening until late that night because Natalie didn't even send her any kind of information about Michael. She sent him the picture at 10:30 p.m. That is when she finally tells Michael's mom, hey, your son is at the hospital. Here's what's been going on. And Natalie tells her, we're at the hospital, tells Donna the wrong hospital. Here's the thing. Donna was a registered nurse for 30 years. So choosing not to clue her in to her own son's medical emergency until 10:30 that night and then telling her the wrong hospital seems an awful lot like Natalie was purposefully trying to keep Donna away so that she could let her scheme play out without as much interference. Now, after Donna got to Michael's room, she finally saw her son. And at this point, he is unresponsive. He's intubated. He's on a ventilator. And she is devastated. At one point, a nurse came in to assess his neurological response. She, too, performed a sternal rub again to test for consciousness. And when she did, Michael actually sat up and opened his eyes, which startled everyone. And for a moment, there was hope. It looked like he was fighting, like he could come out of this. But that response was brief. He did not regain sustained consciousness. He did not speak. He did not make any kind of meaningful communication. Doctors determined he had suffered severe hypoglycemia. His brain had been deprived of glucose for too long and swelling had begun. And over the next several days, he remained hospitalized. He was transferred between facilities and he never returned to baseline. On February 10th, Natalie signed a do not resuscitate order. And shortly after, Michael was transferred to hospice, Bowers Hospice House specifically. He was removed from the ventilator for transport and did breathe on his own briefly. But by 12:18 a.m. on February 11th of 2019, Michael Brandon Cochran was pronounced dead. His official cause of death was listed as brain swelling due to hypoglycemia. The manner of death at the time was initially ruled natural. At that point, there was no homicide investigation. No one had been arrested. No charges had been filed. On paper, this was a tragic medical event. But almost immediately, things felt rushed. Within 2 days, Natalie held a small memorial service. It was described as brief and limited. Some of Michael's closest friends weren't even included. Donna later said it did not reflect who her son was or what he would have wanted. It just kind of felt hurried and controlled, like she was just checking off a box, like, well, Michael's gone, so I guess we gotta have a funeral and then we'll get back to business as usual. And then instead of stepping back, instead of withdrawing from business matters like a normal grieving widow, instead of focusing solely on grieving, or their children, for that matter, Natalie pivoted. She went right back to work. Her companies did not dissolve after Michael's death. They continued operating. Natalie continued communicating with investors. She continued telling them that their returns were coming. She continued asking for money in some instances. And then she did something that even now people struggle to process. She created a scholarship in Michael's name. It was called the Coach Michael Cochran Legacy Scholarship. In May of 2019, just 3 months after his death, she announced that 8 local students would receive full ride scholarships for up to 8 years of schooling. These parents were told that their tuition would be covered, that they could literally stop any kind of like loan application process or scholarship application process. You don't even worry about that. I've got it for up to 8 years. You want to be a doctor? I'll pay for it. That's no skin off my back. Parents were literally told their tuition would be covered, and they were promised $7,500 for personal expenses on top of that. It obviously sounded too good to be true because it was. The money never came. There was no scholarship fund. This was yet another illusion. I know you're probably thinking of like Michael Scott's Scott's Tots. I'm a huge Office fan. You guys know I quote The Office almost every episode. Of course, that's what I'm thinking of. But I'm also thinking of Corey Richens, who is currently going through her trial for the death of her husband, Eric Richens, that she allegedly poisoned and then wrote a children's book afterwards. It's like these women, they think they've gotten away with it, and they're so audacious in the way that they think they've gotten away with a crime that they're like doing these next step grandiose things that just puts the spotlight even more on them. We love a dumb criminal. I'll just say that. Now, by June of 2019, law enforcement was officially involved because investors at this point were still demanding their money. Donna and Ed still had not been repaid their retirement savings. Their friends started comparing notes, and their excuses were starting to contradict each other, so they started taking it to authorities. At this point, federal authorities have been tipped off by these unhappy investors who believed the business was fraudulent. And so a search warrant was executed at Natalie's home on June 25th of 2019. During that search, investigators found something that would later become central to the murder case, which was a vial of Humalog insulin that was left in the refrigerator. Again, neither Natalie nor Michael had diabetes. There was no reason for her to have insulin sitting in her refrigerator. Now, investigators spoke with Donna that same day, and this was the first time that she heard directly that the contracts were not real, that there was no government money, that there were no contracts. It was all a farce, and that her retirement savings were gone. Imagine learning that at the same time, realizing that the authorities are asking questions about your son's death. At first, Natalie was arrested only on fraud-related charges in September of 2019. She was indicted on 26 counts, including wire fraud, bank fraud, and aggravated identity theft. She eventually pled guilty on 2 counts, the wire fraud and money laundering, and was sentenced in 2021 to 11 years and 3 months in federal prison, along with $2.6 million in restitution. But that is not the end, because as investigators dug deeper into the financial timeline, and especially into February 6th, the focus would eventually shift back to Michael. Why did he collapse that morning? Why was there insulin in the home? Why was medical care delayed for hours despite her being a medical professional? And why was that Virginia bank trip canceled the same day? In November of 2021, Natalie was indicted on first-degree murder charges related to Michael's death. What had originally been ruled natural was now being called into question. Just months after Natalie's fraud arrest, investigators made a significant decision. They asked to exhume Michael's body. So the first exhumation took place in September of 2019, roughly 7 months after his death. This was not something that was done casually. Exhumations require court approval. They're usually reserved for cases where investigators believe that something critical may have been missed, and you've got to jump through a lot of hoops to actually even get that approved. So what exactly were they looking for? Well, at that point, they are trying to determine whether Michael's death could have been caused by an insulin overdose. But here's the problem with that. Insulin does not behave like many other poisons. It's a hormone that naturally occurs in the body, and it breaks down quickly after death. It doesn't linger in the way that some toxins do. So detecting exogenous or injected insulin, that's complicated, especially months later. So during that first exhumation, medical examiners were primarily looking for evidence of any injection sites, signs inconsistent with a natural hypoglycemic event. They were looking for tissue samples that could potentially be analyzed for insulin markers. And then, of course, any other overlooked trauma or alternate causes of death. But by that point, decomposition had already progressed significantly. The first exhumation did not really yield definitive proof of insulin poisoning. So they did not have the smoking gun that they needed. And without clear forensic confirmation, the case had to remain circumstantial. So at that point, at that moment, you know, backing up to 2019, prosecutors needed more. And they knew that they were close because they knew Michael had been very close to uncovering the truth about her fraud. So prosecutors continued consulting forensic experts. And eventually, they made the decision to exhume Michael's body for a second time for more advanced testing. So in November of 2021, while Natalie was already serving her federal fraud sentence, a Raleigh County grand jury indicted her for first-degree murder in Michael's death. The prosecution's theory was straightforward. Michael was getting too close to discovering the Ponzi scheme. The Virginia bank visit would have exposed everything. Natalie used insulin to induce severe hypoglycemia, and then she stalled medical intervention long enough for brain damage to occur. But the challenge was that they still did not have direct toxicological proof of injected insulin. Again, insulin is incredibly difficult to prove post-mortem, especially months later. It metabolizes, it breaks down, and that second exhumation didn't provide any new information from the first. So at this point, prosecutors are kind of like praying that this circumstantial case will be enough to convict. But while they could not definitively detect injected insulin in the way that you might detect cyanide or arsenic, the medical examiner ultimately testified that the severity of Michael's hypoglycemia, a blood glucose of 21 in a non-diabetic adult with no prescribed insulin, had no reasonable natural explanation. So in other words, the medical conclusion was that insulin overdose was the only explanation that was consistent with the clinical picture. So that opinion became the backbone of the prosecution's case. And on October 23rd of 2023, Natalie was re-indicted on first-degree murder charges. Now, this time, prosecutors were prepared to argue the case without needing a smoking gun toxicology report, but instead they built it on the timeline, the motive, opportunity, behavior, and medical improbability. And they leaned heavily on what happened in the hours before and after the collapse. The trial was initially scheduled for August of 2024. It didn't happen. There were multiple delays. Some were procedural, some were strategic. At one point, the lead prosecutor resigned amid an unrelated investigation, which further delayed proceedings. And then Raleigh County prosecutor Tom Truman came out of retirement to take over the case. He and co-counsel had to review over 70,000 pages of case files. The trial was ultimately set for January 13th of 2025, 6 years after Michael's death. After weeks of testimony, the jury deliberated for roughly 2 hours before they returned a verdict: guilty of first-degree murder. Then came the mercy phase. So in West Virginia, a jury can recommend mercy, which would make a defendant eligible for parole after 15 years. But in this case, the jury declined to grant mercy. So Natalie Cochran was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. She became the first woman in West Virginia since 1991 to receive a life sentence without mercy for murder. Now, at the center of all of this, the fraud, the trial, the headlines, was Michael, a son who was close to his mom and stepdad, a dad who showed up to all the practices and the games he was involved, a guy who built his own home, coached his kids, helped friends when they were struggling. He wasn't perfect, no one is, but the people who knew him consistently described the same thing, that he cared, he worked hard, and he loved his family. And whatever you believe about every twist in this case, those things, those parts, don't change. He was 38 years old. He should still be here. And at the end of this story, there are now two kids left without a parent. That is it for today's episode of Mama Mystery. If you have a friend or know someone who is interested in true crime, share this story with them, share the podcast with them. It's just a way that helps get the show seen by new eyes and new ears. And I appreciate you all for being here, sticking through this long episode. Until next week, stay safe, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery.